Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Did you know that Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bissinger was addicted to buying leather pants? Or that there's a rare brain condition where you believe that you're already dead and don't exist? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I am here in the studio with Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Well, Stephen, we are here today to bring the people something that I did.
That's right. What really excites me about this entire episode is that I had nothing to do with it.
That's right.
I had to do nothing.
That's right. You didn't. At a recent NPR event, I had an opportunity to sit down with Trevor Noah, who is the current host of The Daily Show, took over, as many of you know, in September after Jon Stewart's departure earlier in the year. He and I talked about comedy. We talked about his life in South Africa. We talked about The Daily Show. We talked about diversity on television. Wow, it's a really interesting conversation. I thought it was. Not because of me, but because of him. He's a very interesting and smart guy. And fortunately, we are getting to bring this audio to our audience. We're going to take a very quick break and come back, and you will hear that conversation that I had with Trevor Noah.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Makespace. For people who dream about having a bigger closet and never want to visit a storage unit again, Makespace is like having an infinite closet. Here's how it works. Makespace picks up your stuff for free. They take it to storage for you, and they bring it back whenever you want. And now Makespace is giving all listeners $50 of free storage. Just schedule a pickup at makespace.com or download the Makespace app and enter promo code POP.
Trevor Noah has had a successful stand-up career in South Africa, including not only the stand-up but also award show hosting, late-night talk show, even some time on the radio. And his first appearance on The Daily Show was in December of 2014, less than a year ago. And then in February of 2015, Jon Stewart announced that he was leaving the show. And by the end of March, Trevor Noah had been announced as his successor. He's been doing the show for about a month. The first one was end of September. So we are enormously pleased to welcome to Weekend in Washington, Trevor Noah.
Thank you very much.
How's the first month gone?
It's gone. That's what it's done. It's gone. It's gone really well. It's an exciting job to be in. A lot more than what I anticipated it to be. A lot more scrutiny, a lot more expectation. It's exciting, but it's sad at the same time, I think.
Sad how?
It's sad that a comedy show is looked to be the number one source of authentic news in a place. I did not anticipate how much journalism I would have to do. So,
right.
Yeah. So, but other than that, it's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Do you hustle to get that job, or is that a job where you figure if they want to call me, they'll call me?
Oh, it's a job you don't even think of doing. I've always loved comedy. That's my first love. And so, as a comedian, you know, you operate in a world where there are very few opportunities, few and far between, where you get to reach a plateau where you get to say you've done something, you know. So maybe we host an award show here and there, you get to do something special every now and again, but for the most part, comedians work in an underground world, and we grind away doing what we do. So one of the greatest accolades for a comedian is to work with people that you've looked up to your whole life, great comedians that have done different things. So whether it's the Chris Rocks or the Jerry Seinfelds or the, you know, or the Jon Stewarts or the, you know, the Eddie Murphys, that's really what you're looking to, is to just meet these people, work with them, tap into their minds. And so for me, just meeting Jon Stewart and working with him was in itself the accolade. That's all I wanted to do, was to learn from him, have a great time. And that's how we started working together. We just enjoyed each other's company. We talked about the same things, but from different, very different places. And so my aim was to commute, come to the US, do, you know, some Daily Show appearances, carry on touring the rest of the world. And then John decided to leave.
He did indeed.
And then the chaos started.
The chaos did start. It only lasted, I mean, it only lasted a little over a month, right?
Yeah, yeah. It feels a lot longer. If you're in a tornado, it feels long.
Did you feel?
Someone could tell you, that tornado was only 2 hours. You'd be like, felt a lot longer than that, to be honest.
Did you feel in that chaos that entire time? Was it clear the entire time that was a job that maybe they were going to look at you for?
Not necessarily, no. No, I think I was blessed with one thing, and that was... my perspective, I was removed from the entire situation. So in my world, Jon Stewart was huge, you know, but The Daily Show, ironically, The Daily Show in most parts of the world is carried by CNN. So I remember the first time I watched The Daily Show, it was on CNN, and I just thought Jon Stewart was a news anchor who did not take his job seriously at all. And so... I had no clue how big this show was, which I think helped me, because had I known that, I do not know that I would have been as confident in saying yes to it. You know, yeah. John always says that he tricked me for the right reasons, and that's how I ended up here for the right reasons.
What was that period between March and September like?
Wow, it was a time warp, you know, in many senses of the word. You're looking at the show, what people believe the show is, what they believe the show should be, what Jon Stewart has meant to many people, both people who agreed with him and people disagreed with him, what the show stood for. And then you're looking at beginning the journey of creating what you would hope would be the next journey, you know, the next step in the journey. What is your legacy? What are you trying to create? What do you feel is important? Because that's the hardest thing that a lot of people don't understand. And that was the mandate. The only mandate Jon gave me was, make your show. Make the show that you feel needs to be made. He goes, there is no Daily Show. The Daily Show is dead. This is now your show that is called The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. So you have to take that and move forward with that. And it's a very difficult thing to try and do, because it's a fine balance between breaking what needs to be broken, but at the same time maintaining the integrity of a fantastic show that I myself was a fan of.
What do you think were the things that you thought of as maybe needed to be broken or changed about the show?
That's a tough one, because what you're doing is you're not breaking it because you think it was something that John or the show wasn't doing correctly. It's just what you feel you need to do for yourself, you know. So on my side, for instance, obviously coming from a totally different background, by the mere fact that I'm a black person, that already changes some of the stories I would look at, some of the angles that I would take, some of the things that I would feel are more pertinent to what I should be covering or how I should be covering it, you know? So already just your interests, you know, like in the last few years, John was really, really interested in the Middle East. And obviously, being an American, going through Iraq and what happened with Bush, that was something that he was extremely passionate about, because he felt like it was a huge disaster. And so I come in with a different perspective. I'm new, I'm fresh, I do not hold many of these preconceived notions of politics in America and things that have happened. So you have to find what's new to you, you have to find what's important to you, and then you get into it and you just do it every single day.
What kinds of things have been most important to you to cover on the show and go more deeply into on the show, maybe?
First and foremost, the funniest things, which luckily for me, there's a political party that handles that. I won't mention who they are. No, it's the funniest things for me, first and foremost, because John always said this, and I never understood why he always said it, you know, that I'm a comedian, this is a comedy show, I'm a comedian. I never understood why he kept on saying, I was like, but we know this, everyone knows it. And then I realized, no, people don't know that. A lot of people do not know that, and I understand why. And so I always look for the funny. But I've always believed in comedy, that comedy is truth. You know, that's why people laugh. When you tell a joke, when you say something, the visceral reaction that comes from within other people is elicited by the acknowledgement of some truth. And so if you are true to yourself, if you pursue your comedy, I find you will pursue the truth. And my truth is often in and around what is happening in the world that I live in. So whether it comes to race and race relations, which has been a huge product of my existence coming from South Africa and seeing that in America, I always said America feels like a second home to me, because the racism is familiar out here, which is really which is really wonderful. No, because I understand it. I understand it's very simple. It's very, you know, like when you go to places, like if you go to Europe, for instance, it's very layered, it's very subtle. There's a very different game that is being played. But in America, I understand it. You know, I understand the history of black people who've been oppressed. I understand, you know, young people now going, but how is that our fault? The sins of our fathers, how do we pay for it? I understand all of that. And so I'm very comfortable operating within this current atmosphere.
Yeah, there's a documentary about you from a couple years ago that's called You Laugh, But It's True.
Yes.
And in that documentary, which is about, if you're interested in kind of the Trevor Noah story, I recommend that movie. It's really interesting and it's streaming on Netflix. But there's a moment in there where there are a bunch of white South African comedians who are talking about, the thing about black South African comedians is they spend all their time talking about race, and I don't understand why, because it's over and you have to get past it.
Yeah.
That's even more surprising perhaps than people who do it here, because at the time is even shorter since even the most official stuff was changed. I mean, is that your sense?
That happens everywhere. People go, it's done, it's over, because if you weren't the person who was being oppressed, or if you weren't suffering through a time, when a regime ends or when a law changes, in your eyes, it has changed, it has ended. The hardest thing to understand is the law changing or a system being broken down, that's the beginning. You know, so when they say the end of slavery in America, that's the beginning of the journey. When they say, you know, black people getting equal rights, that's the beginning of the journey. And it's hard for people because everyone wants to go, oh, that's the end. It's done. It's not done. Now we have to start the hard work from both sides, you know. So that's something that I understand innately, because it's easy for somebody to say, okay, it's over, you're done. Why are you still talking about race? You know, because race is what forged my entire nation. Race is, if you look into every single issue that divides people, I think maybe there's only four in the world, really, and race is one of those, you know? If you look at how many problems we have, how many conversations, it always comes back down to race and the way that we deal with race relations. You know, the same thing happened with when I look at the police in America, and I think it was Barack Obama who said, the police are a product of the public, which is true. You know, people are looking at it as they go, this is a police problem, and you go, well, really, it's a society problem. The police happen to be law enforcement from that society, and that's what we need to be looking at. So it's a symptomatic approach as opposed to us looking at the core of the problem and trying to fix that.
So it's clear that you have all these really strong feelings about all of this stuff, and these are the things that you want to talk about, and these are the things that I think a lot of your comedy has always talked about. How do you reconcile, on the one hand, you do want to get at those questions, and on the other hand, you still want, as you said, to be doing a comedy show, don't necessarily want people to be looking to you for news, but at the same time, you have something that you're trying to say. How does that balance work for you?
I love the idea that people are looking to The Daily Show for news. That is something I enjoy. Somewhere along the line, I don't know if it was through boring programming or just horrible newscasters, I feel like society was tricked into believing that news was for the elite, for the few, for the boring, for the old, and that's not the truth. News is for everyone. News is supposed to be consumed by every single person. The same way politics should be consumed by everyone. I mean, the word originates from the Greek, for the people. That is exactly what it's supposed to be. But we, you know, you get to this world where it becomes, oh, that's boring, the news, it's, you know. So I do want people to come to The Daily Show for the news. It's just in terms of what people want me to do with the news is where I go. Comedy is my number one focus. The truth will come from that. We have a saying at the show now, which is sad, is sometimes we'll want to talk about a topic, and we'll go, we want to talk about race relations, or we want to talk about inequality, we want to talk about gender and income inequality. Whatever it is, we have these conversations in the office, and we go, man, I wish we could talk about this. And we always say, well, unfortunately, I think we will be afforded the opportunity because it's not going away, you know.
Yeah.
So I'll wait. We literally sit in the office and we go, we want to talk about police brutality, and we say, well, we don't have the right story to talk about it now. And we go, well, if you wait a few days or a few weeks, that won't be a problem anymore. And it's crazy, but that's the situation we're in right now. So I always say, worst case scenario, everything fixes itself in America. The Daily Show has nothing to talk about. And I go home and I go, well, I lost, but everyone else won. And until then, I'll keep talking about the things.
Yeah. In terms of the structure of the show, one of the things that has struck me about it is I think you are doing somewhat less comedy about media coverage of things,
yes,
and more comedy about the underlying thing. Because the first thing I had heard about your show was that you were interested in kind of where news coverage was going in terms of BuzzFeed and stuff like that. But that hasn't really been as much what I've seen. What I've seen is covering the underlying story more.
Yes.
Is that something that you felt like I'm more interested in that than in the kind of going through kind of...
Well, it's about building the relationship first. Let's talk about the thing. It's the same thing I would do in stand-up comedy, the same thing you do in any conversation. I like to get to know people. I like for people to get to know me. And the best way we can do that is talk about the issues themselves first, you know? A lot of people don't realize or forget that John evolved into the man that he was at the end of his tenure. That was 16 years of work that got him to that point. And for you to try and rush that evolution, for you to try and rush that growth, would be robbing myself, the show, and the viewer of an opportunity to build a solid foundation that gets us to where we need to go. So for now, it's my first experience of a Republican debate as a host of The Daily Show.
Right.
It is my first experience of Donald Trump and his hair. It is my first experience of Ben Carson. These are all first experiences for me. So for me to run ahead of myself and carry on the journey, per se, that doesn't make sense. I have to start from the beginning and say, this is my first experience. And I was surprised to find that for many people, it is also their first experience. They go, actually, I wasn't watching The Daily Show, or I feel like I caught it in the middle and I could drive it. This is a great time to jump in and join the conversation. And people who have been watching go, oh, I never thought of it like that, or that was an interesting take that you had, or that was something that I hadn't previously thought. I never thought that Donald Trump was an African president. So
that's a great bet.
So those are things.
That's a great bet.
Those are the things that I'm trying to create. As when it comes to the media, I think John had that, right, because he himself had achieved a certain level of journalism integrity himself. Who am I to skewer the media when I don't feel that I have created enough of a solid foundation? You know, I wouldn't do that. So when I found my footing 100% or as close to it as possible, then I can start looking outwards. But I believe there's so much right now that I don't even need to be skewering media just yet.
It seems like in terms of the job that you got when you got this job, Jon Stewart was the host of the show, but was also the boss of the show.
Yes.
What is it like to come in when you've been with the show in a different capacity for a shorter time? There was a fair amount of holdovers on the writing staff and producers at the beginning, correct?
Yes.
How do you come in? Can you be the boss of the show? Do you have to ease your way into being the boss of the show?
You have to be the boss of the show. It's as simple, and it's not even the boss. I really don't like the term boss. People say it, but I think of it like sports. I'm a captain. You know, we're a team. That's really what we are. We're a team. We win, we lose. Yes, the bulk of it will be on my shoulders if we lose, and the praise will also fall on my shoulders. So I understand that, but we're a team. And the team requires all the moving parts to work in unison. You know, so my duty is to make sure that everybody is moving in the right direction and they're helping me to execute the vision that I think we need to execute. You know, so it's their opinions combined with my vision, and then we try and mold that into getting to the right place. But it really is a team effort. You can't just do it as a boss, per se.
Sure.
And that's the one thing that John blessed me with is, A, the ability to be part of the family before he left. So I wasn't a stranger in the room. I already had an office. I had a tiny little office. They had to force me to move into John's office. I was like, I like my office. It's fine.
What was your tiny little office like?
I just had just like a little office with a little brown desk and a window at the top that comes in, like a little skylight, which I really liked. And then John's office has a, what do you call that, with the exposed brick?
Oh.
Which I'm not a fan of. I don't. No, it's a strange, you see, like this is one of those strange things culturally. So exposed brick is a classic example of privilege in my world. Because coming from South Africa, coming from any poor country, to be honest, exposed brick displays that you do not have the ability to plaster your walls and paint them. You don't have enough money to do that. So all we had growing up was exposed brick. And then you move to a place where everyone goes, we have so much plaster and so much paint. In order for me to be different, I'm going to expose the bricks in my walls. And everyone goes, that is so fantastic. I will pay more for that. And so all I see is a reminder of where I came from, and I'm like, we need plaster on those walls, please.
That's a pretty common American affectation, isn't it? Though,
like, I don't even think it's American. It's what comes with it. I honestly find, and it's not a bad thing. It's just what comes with privilege is the fascination with the lack thereof. That's what just generally happens. It's the same thing with camping. No one in a third world country goes camping because that's how we live. That's right. Not, you know what I mean?
This is or like peasant food.
Yeah, it's not something that entices me. Why would I want to go and stay outdoors? I lived outdoors. Why would I want to? This is so all of those things. It's a fascination with the world that you're not privy to because, I guess, of privilege.
Yeah, I was watching you with Jerry Seinfeld on the web series Jerry Seinfeld has, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, in which he gets in a very fancy car with someone in comedy and drive around, talk about various things. And he was talking about this crazy schedule that you were keeping at one time, going back and forth between, I want to say, London and New York. And he said, where do you think that work ethic comes from? And you said, being poor.
Yes.
And he cracked up laughing. And I thought, it's funny, but at the same time, I wondered if it was weird to be with a guy like that in a car like that, trying to have a conversation about how being poor affects the way that you look at the world.
No, not at all. One of the greatest things I think I was blessed with is, well, two things really. My mom and growing up in the era of Nelson Mandela. Two people that taught me that you do not need or you shouldn't let the anger around what has happened to you consume you. It doesn't mean you should forget what has happened to you. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try and fix it or correct the errors of the past. But the anger itself will consume you. You know. So if I get angry that I grew up poor and Jerry didn't, I mean, that's not his fault. It's not. You get what I'm saying? This is not you. I find that as people, we tend to live in a place where you can get angry, and that anger then consumes you, and you go, I hate rich people. And it's like, why do you hate them? Because they don't know what it's like to be poor. And it's like, but that's not their fault, mm-hmm. You know? So you get to a place where you go, oh, it's not angry. This is what shaped me. This is what molded me. I'm blessed enough to be in the place that I am now. I know what it is like to be very, very, very poor. So I don't see it as coming from an angry place. So I get to laugh about these things because I don't think being poor is funny, but there's nothing funny about most things in the world. But even when we were poor as a family, we were able to laugh. So that's one thread that I have that goes through life is laughter. And that's the thing that connects most people. In that conversation, I can laugh about it because it's something I had never thought of. Is why do you work so hard? Because I'm just terrified of being poor. It's just something that, you know, I don't work because I go, oh, I want the money. I just go, no, I want to not be poor. That's what I want.
Are there other ways in which you feel like that has stayed with you and affects the way that you live now?
Yeah, I struggle to fly fancy or, like, for instance, recently I was going to, was it the Emmys? And then someone suggested I get a stylist. And then I inquired as to how much a stylist cost. And I was told anywhere between $5,000 and $25,000.
Per what?
Per styling.
Per individual event.
Yeah, I thought it was to buy the person as well, but it's not. It's not.
I was gonna say.
No.
What do you get for that?
This is what people. I was shocked to find this. This is what people are paying for these. Like, and I couldn't bring myself. I was like, I cannot pay. I would rather spend all the. In fact, I said I would rather take the money, go and buy one outfit myself. Take a chance on that red carpet, you know, have it out with the fashion police, and then take the rest of the money and give it to charity, and then at least I know every time I'm on the, no, it's just like, then I know every time I'm on the worst dressed list, there's a bunch of kids cheering because they know they got the money that I would have spent looking good. So I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy nice things. I'm not saying I don't enjoy it, but there are certain opulences that I cannot bring myself to enjoy because it's just too much for me. So those are small things that I never forget, where I came from and the value of a hard-earned dollar.
I wanted to ask you about something else that came up in that documentary that's so interesting, was a point that you made. I think you were talking about the idea of going back to the township where your grandmother lived.
Yes.
And said, I don't go back there, I go to visit my grandmother.
Yes.
And that seemed to be a really important distinction to you.
Yes.
But it wasn't totally clear from the film all of what it meant, but it seemed to be important to you.
Well, so if someone says, you grew up in Soweto, a dusty township filled with shacks and people living in tin houses and outdoor plumbing, and now you don't live there, and they go, do you ever go back? It implies, the connotation for me implies that I've left it behind. And when in effect, I haven't. It is who I am, you know? And Soweto itself, the place is beautiful because what happened in Soweto is people decided, instead of leaving this place that was the birthplace of a movement, instead of leaving this place that really sparked democracy in South Africa, they would improve the place. You know, so people said, I have this piece of land, it is tiny, I have a horrible little house with exposed brick, let me build on this, let me bring this new money in, let me improve this area that made me who I am. And that's what my grandmother's done. My grandmother, you know, she has the fruits of the family. My mom has done well, I've done well, but my grandmother goes, this is our home, I live here. Because if everyone leaves, this place never gets better. Where do we go from there? We're basically part of that same problem. So I don't go back there, I just go and visit. You know, I don't go back. People go, do you go back to South Africa? Oh, I just go to South Africa. I don't go, it implies regression in my mind. And so I just refuse to use that terminology. They go, you're going back to South Africa? I don't go back to South Africa. I go visit South Africa. The same way I don't go back to Italy or back to France. I just go visit these places because I'm a child of the world. I'm a citizen of the world. So I always think of it like that, is that, you know, because I cannot think of it as being backwards. I cannot think of it as that because then, deep down inside, I feel like I will shun it, and I don't want to do that. So I just go there to enjoy myself, and I get to see the growth, which is always wonderful.
So in terms of your own trajectory, how long did you do stand-up before you came to the United States?
I'd been doing comedy for 7 years before I came to the U.S. It was actually really just great Americans that I'd met in comedy and in different spaces. The guy who made that documentary, I'd never known him before. He was an American guy, a young Jewish American, David Paul Meyer, who came to South Africa. As a South African, you get these requests all the time. You know, it's some American who wants to film your hunger. And I didn't have time anymore. You get so bored of it. But this guy was different. You know, he came and he said, I want to film comedy in South Africa. I want to film the story. I want to film in a world where people think there is only one thing, I want to show that there is something different. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I can help you do that. And so he connected with all the comedians, and he went around with us, and he wasn't afraid to delve into the world of South Africa, you know, whether it was race, whether it was politics, whether it was socioeconomic. And he took his time as well. I think it took him four years to complete the project. And so I got to know this guy. And I mean, he himself was a paradox, which I really enjoyed, because I'm mixed, you know, I'm half Xhosa, South African, and then half Swiss. I grew up in a world where you had to be defined by the color of your skin, and yet my color was a contradiction. And so he was the same in my world. Here he was, a Jewish guy from North Carolina, so he's got this southern accent and semi-racist views, and, you know, but conflicted because he is a liberal, and I just really enjoyed. I enjoyed this beautiful coming together. He was a real person to me, which I really enjoyed. You know, we grew together. And he said, I think you should come to America and do comedy. And you don't do that. You know, that was out of this world. And he said, you should do it. I'll put a show together. Come there and tell jokes and let's see how it goes. I said, well, I mean, this is, I'll do that. I'll trust you. I said, I don't know if I should. Leave Africa with a white guy and go to America. I don't know. I don't know if this will end well, but I trusted him. I trusted him. We just found a connection, and he helped me realize that connection could happen anywhere in the world. We focus so much on how different we are, and yet you'll be shocked. I would have never thought that I would meet and become best friends with some random guy from North Carolina. That wasn't my world. You know, and then here I am today, and that's how the journey began for me. And then I just committed to America, because I also got here and I realized how ignorant the world is towards America, because everyone in the world, I hope I'm not shocking you by saying this, thinks that America is an ignorant place.
You are not shocking me.
Yeah, but everyone says that, oh, Americans are stupid. Americans know nothing about the world. Americans. And then I came to America and I was like, when people would ask me, they go, what's America like? I said, I can't tell you, because America's so big. It's so broad. It's so, are you saying the West Coast? Are you saying the East? What parts of America do you want to know about? And so as I journeyed weekend to weekend, city to city, I realized the place was so much bigger than I couldn't just visit it and say I'd been here. And so I dedicated about 2 years. And it was 2 years primarily spent just finding comedy clubs where they'd let me perform. Most of the shows were free. And I just went around learning America, meeting people, places like El Paso, Texas, and Erie, Pennsylvania, and Nashville, Tennessee, and I remember, was it line dancing? That's what I was doing, I think.
You were line dancing?
I think I was line dancing.
How was it?
It was really fun.
It was
really, really cool. Yeah, I had a great time. That was my introduction to America.
The comedy that you did when you were in South Africa was, a lot of the time, based on what I've seen, pretty specific to South African politics, sometimes South African culture. What's the process of deciding to then export that to places where some of those things won't be as familiar to people? Do you kind of adjust the work as you go when you come to America and are doing it? I mean, some of that stuff will fly in Erie, Pennsylvania, and some of it won't, right?
Oh, none of it flies in Erie, Pennsylvania. I remember when I was in Erie, it was hilarious. What a wonderful place. I was staying in like a tiny, I think it was like a motel or one of those opposite a Target. And I got picked up by, you have to phone, this was before Uber or anything like that. And you have to phone the taxi company to come and pick you up from this little motel. And I get into the taxi and the driver says to me, he turns and he says, "Oh, are you the black fella that's in town?" And that was just that moment for me was priceless. I was like,
what happens if you say no?
I was just like, wow, okay, I guess I am. But that was just like a different place. But this is what I found is the more I traveled, the more I realized comedy's universal. Everybody loves to laugh. It's a release that we all enjoy, that we need. And I've been lucky in that I think because of where I come from as a person, I had to learn to adopt so many cultures around me to blend in because I didn't fit in anywhere in South Africa. South Africa was divided up racially, but I mean, like people always go, what was apartheid? Apartheid was honestly the best racism in the world. They studied racism everywhere. They went to Australia, they studied from the Dutch. They looked at how to best implement racism and racial segregation. And so the key to this, because you must remember, South Africa is 90% black people. So the key to oppressing so many people is to find ways to divide them up. You divide and conquer. And so that is dividing people up into separate, smaller groups. You have to find the intricacies that separate people and point them out so that those people also believe them. So I grew up in a world where, legally speaking, my father's one racial group, my mother's another racial group, and I'm another racial group, which means all three of us have different laws that apply to us. All three of us can live in different areas. All three of us, even if we were in prison, each of us would receive different rations, different types of food, be given different clothing. That is how crazy it is. Within one family, all three of you are experiencing a country in three different ways. You know, so I had to learn just within my family how to adapt to many different worlds. And that thing has served me well because when I travel, when I'm in the middle of a random place in America, I've learned how to blend. I enjoy it. I think I've spent so much time being taught how to see the differences in people that I grew up going, well, what are the things that make us similar? And so wherever I go to, I find a similarity with people, and then I get going. And so with my comedy, I do the same thing. I make the comedy for where I am, everywhere in the world, from Dubai through to Africa, through to America, through to Europe. I make the comedy for where I am because it's happening around me and it's my truth.
One of the things that you've talked about in terms of the development of The Daily Show is the way that your vision intersects with who you're working with at The Daily Show. And there was a very interesting conversation with, I think, the New York Times, where you were talking about hiring more women, and you were also talking about something that I think you called an epidemic of blackness at The Daily Show. I'm curious about that process for you, because I know that you talked about how a part of that was easier for you because of the people that you knew already.
Yes.
Is that right? And I'm wondering what you think the steps are, if they don't have you to come in and do something like that, what the steps are for organizations that are trying to get past what I think you were referring to as institutional segregation.
Yes.
Coming from people working with the people that they already know, which tends to be kind of a paperclip chain of this person yes. knows this person knows this person. What? How do you get around that other than having a new captain of the team come in who has different people?
The hardest thing to do is acknowledging that you have a problem. So this is what often happens, I feel. Let's say in America, it's the same in South Africa, you'll have a lot of white people who are liberal, people who are progressive, people who are going, I want change, I vote for change, this is what I agree with this, I believe there should be more integration, I believe that, and I'm for it 100%. And then they'll say things like, and I believe in equal opportunities, so everyone can interview for this job. What people don't realize is, just because of the world we've lived in, because of the limitations that have been placed on the access that people of color and women have had to getting to those positions, the networks that we use to try and get to them are limited. So you say, I've opened this position up to anybody. Black people are welcome to apply. Do black people hear that application invitation? You know, women are welcome to, do women hear that application invitation? You end up being trapped in a cycle of not hiring anyone because you think you're open, you genuinely do. You go, I'm hiring anybody, but the anybodies that happen to come there will always be the same people because the people you talk to, your friends and your colleagues, are the same. Hey, do you know any good people? Yeah, I know some good people. And those people are always going to be the same. So what I'm very conscious of is trying to correct that, is trying to find and unearth talent and voices that maybe haven't been reached out to. I'll give you an example. So when we were looking for new correspondents for The Daily Show, they send out a mass email to all the agents and all the managers. They say, we're looking for talent. All talent is welcome to apply. We get a barrage of submissions. In these submissions, of 1,000 or 100, let's say, of the 100 that I saw, maybe 4 were black people. So I remember the first thing I said was, do black people not like The Daily Show? Do they not want to, I mean, even if they're going to lie and just say they want the job, are they not even willing to do that? And then people are like, oh, that's all we got. These are the submissions. I was like, but that's not possible. I'm pretty certain there's more than 4 black people who would like to be on The Daily Show. And they said, well, this is all we're getting. These are the submissions. And I couldn't understand this. I genuinely couldn't. And one night I got the answer. I was walking into the Comedy Cellar, the comedy club in New York. And I walked past a table. And at that table was about 5 or 6 young black comedians, right? And one of them, my friend Monroe, he turned to me and he said, yo, Trevor, he said, you're going to tell us if you need any black people on The Daily Show, right? And I said, I thought he was mocking me. Mm-hmm. So I thought he was basically going, because we are not going to join. That's what I thought he was. I thought that was a joke.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And so I laughed and I said, are you being serious? And he said, no, I'm being dead serious. Let us know if you want. And I said, who's us? And everyone at the table raised their hands. I said, you guys all want to be on The Daily Show? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, have you sent a tape in? And they all said, no. And I said, why not? I said, because no one's asked us to send a tape. I said, well, what about your agents or managers? They said, we don't have agents. We don't have managers. And then I sat down with the guys and they were like, most black comedians can't get representation. Most black comedians can't get someone who's willing to pick them up. Few and far between will have that opportunity, but for the most part, they don't. And so you think you're reaching out. You think you are actively trying to get these people, but the people don't hear your call. And that moment was when I realized that I had to be more proactive than just saying, I want, and actually go out and find. And that was really how I stumbled upon Roy Wood Jr., who's been amazing on the show. He's just been, he's a phenomenal, smart, funny black man. Found him through a network, just asked everyone.
Yeah.
I just phoned every single person I knew, every black person and every person that I thought knows black people. And I searched, and I searched, and I searched, and I was like, I'm going to find. It's the same thing I'm doing with female writers, because they go, oh, well, you know, you don't get a lot of comedy female. And I go, that can't be right. Find, let us find. We will actively search and seek the people out. And I think that's the thing, is the active versus passive. In any organization, if you say you want the change, you have to make that change happen. You have to be fair in this. This is always a tough and contentious issue, because someone goes, we let 2 people write an application, and the white guy had a better one. And you go, yes, but I'm looking specifically for a black person in this position because they will give me something that I don't have. You're not crippling your organization. You're not hampering yourself by getting that black person. Do you get what I'm saying?
I do.
You are increasing diversity. Diversity is fantastic for a market, for a business, for an environment. Diversity is one of the most important things. And so what you need to do is you need to understand that for him to even get to the same level as a historically white recipient or a male applicant implies so much more work that he's gone. It's being twice as good. It's being twice as funny. For a female comedian to be seen as funny as a male, she has to be twice as funny. She's hilarious. She's not just funny, you know. She's hilarious. That's what people always say. And that always sticks in my mind, is that those people have to work so much harder to just get to a level that is generally occupied by a white male. So being active is the most important thing. You can't just say, we want diversity, we want change. You have to actively go, I'm going to make this happen. And then it'll happen.
I think it was also in the New York Times that I read recently a piece about the idea of diversity and how a lot of times it feels to people like work, and they get very frustrated about it as kind of a dry, I think it was an Anna Holmes piece, I want to say. And she was talking about how people think of it as kind of, I got to go do diversity. Because you talked a lot about it in terms of markets and audiences and stuff like that. Do you think people underestimate the capacity that has to actually make your content better?
They do. Completely. And they're right. It is work. You have to go do diversity. It's the same way we have to go do climate change. When you've made a mistake, when we're in a situation where we've broken something, you have to fix it now. That is the work. But the work, the rewards of that work will be fruitful. You know, that's what you have to do. So yes, diversity is work. You have to go do diversity. But people genuinely underestimate the value of that, of having a look in the creative space, for one, I can tell you what a difference it makes. It's just having different eyes, having different voices, having an honest opinion. If a story comes up, let's say we're talking about Planned Parenthood, I don't want to be in a position where I'm going, I wonder how women feel about this. I bet I know how women feel about this. Oh, women's health. Women's health. I know exactly how they feel. I know many women, and I think this is how they feel. Why not just ask them? Why not have women there and you say, how do you feel about this? And let's talk about this. And then there'll be a thing that you'll tell me where I go, wow, I never thought of it like that. A classic example of this, for instance, was catcalling. I come from a world of, I would like to think, extremely progressive individuals who want to better themselves and live in that world. The catcalling video came out. There was a big video, for those who don't know, it was catcalling. And they showed a woman walking through New York City, and she was being, whistled at, and guys were calling out at her, and wolf whistles, and guys saying derogatory things, and some of them saying nice things, but still just hassling as she walked along her journey. And when the video came out, we talked together. It was myself, some comedians, and female comedians as well, and we had this conversation, and I was like, that video was crazy. That was ridiculous. You see what happened to that woman? That was insane. And then I said, but I don't know if catcalling can't be that bad, right? Because it's just a guy saying hi, it's just a guy. And then when our female peers were like, no, it's the worst thing in the world.
It's super gross.
It is the worst thing, because you see it, one man sees it as one, hey, you look good. Every man sees it as that one instance, because he's not with you for your entire journey. But when you think of a 30-minute walk through a city like New York, you've got 100 men who have all come up to you to tell you how nice your boots look. That's a lot of men. That is a lot of vulnerability for one woman to have to experience. That is a lot. But as a man, I'd never thought of it like that. Because as a man, we wish we were catcalled. That's the honest truth. That sounds like a fantastic thing. We just walk through the streets and people tell you how good you look. You're like, yeah, I wish that would happen. But because it's never happened to you, you cannot put yourself in that person's shoes. You cannot experience the true feeling that comes with it. And so that diversity helps you, especially if you're trying to tackle a problem. It's a beautiful thing that you can never artificially create.
One of the other things that, as you talk about the need for comedy or writers to think about the ways in which their own perspectives are limited, another thing I've heard you talk about is kind of separating the idea that comedy and comedians and writers and creators need to be able to learn from times when they do things that perhaps are racist or sexist or whatever, versus also trying to pull back on an environment of kind of everybody being angry all the time.
Yes.
Kind of reflexively. And I've heard you sort of talk about trying to untangle those things from each other, because I think sometimes when people do react to something in comedy and say, I'm offended by that, I think it's sexist, whatever, for some people, there's a very defensive reaction of kind of, it's comedy, if people laugh, whatever. But you seem to be interested in kind of finding a way to care about both of those things. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think what you're speaking about is nuance, the thing we all hate. Because most issues are grounded in nuance. It's so hard. Both sides are right. Two arguments that are opposed can both be correct. And so, comedy being my world, I see this happening right now. It's a tough place to be in. Someone says, I am offended. And then you go, well, then you shouldn't, the other person shouldn't do that anymore, shouldn't say that. That's not true, because offense is taken, is not given. At the same time, though, what the person felt was offensive still needs to be addressed in some shape or form. But it's a slippery slope, because if you say, if people are offended, we should no longer do the thing, by that logic, we shouldn't have gay marriage then. Because there are people who are offended by the notion that same-sex people can put on a wedding ring. They're offended by that. So then do we not have that? And you go, no, but that's a right. And then we get into murky territory. Then you go, okay, well, what about freedom of speech? Hey, you should say whatever you want, but that person was offended by it. Oh, well, then you take it back. I think intent is the most important thing. Mistakes can be made. People can say things that they don't realize are wrong. I think society is always evolving. If you look at the language we use now and you look at the language we used 10 years ago, there's words and phrases and things that were very acceptable years ago. You know, just the way you referred to a gay person, for instance, back in the day, didn't even come from a place of hatred. People would just say a slur that we have now identified as a slur. We slowly identify the power of words. We evolve as human beings. That's what evolution is. But we must also be careful, I think, to not over-censor, because, look, from comedy alone, I'll tell you this. Comedians, the job of a comedian is often to delve into those spaces. I do it personally because I feel like it removes some of its power. It's the reason I talk about racism. I'm not going to act like it's this big boogie monster that can't be tackled, and let's not talk about it, and let's talk about escalators or something. No, I want to talk about this thing. I want to remove the power of the racist. I want to remove the power of racism itself. I remember when I was going to Nashville, Tennessee, I was at the time I was working on a joke that I was writing about the Ku Klux Klan, and there was a driver on the tour bus, and he said to me, he had heard the joke, and he said, he was a black guy, and he said, "Yo, Trev," he said, you know we're going to Nashville, right?" And I said, "Yeah," and he said, "Yeah, you can't be talking none of that shit where we go, man." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, them folks don't like that out there." I said, "Well, that's exactly where I'm going to talk about it then." And I went in and I spoke about it, and people laughed and people understood what I was saying, and that's what comedy is. You know, it's an honest breaking down of a situation. It's sometimes the only place where we can have an honest conversation, because a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, you know? So we must be careful that we don't sterilize society of all conversation, because honestly, the way I feel right now in America is everyone is afraid to say anything because you don't want to say the wrong thing. People are like, should I say, oh, I don't know, do I, yeah, she was right. Women are, and then you go, don't say she, don't say that. Oh, as a straight man, don't say straight, you're not straight, you're cisgender. I'm sorry, what? What just happened here? And now you've fallen into a trap and you don't know. And then all that's going to happen is people are not going to talk. And that's the most beautiful thing about where South Africa is now. We're raw. We're not a perfect country by any means, but we're raw. And the best thing about being raw is we still talk about the things. We stumble into these conversations and we have them. That's something I hope I never lose. You know, I understand there's murky territory in and around comedy and conversations that we have, but we mustn't lose that ability to have honest discourse. You make those mistakes, but the intent is the most important thing. You know, it's for somebody to say to you, hey, actually, that's considered a slur. Oh, I didn't know that. I was not trying to offend you. I did not know that. You know, I didn't know that homo was considered a slur. Where I've never, because I have no bad feelings towards gay people, and it's easy for me to stop saying that word. It's as simple as that. But if we don't have the conversations because nobody's talking, we never change. People just harbor these feelings, and then everyone just sits in their house saying the things, and they go, just don't say it outdoors because I don't know what's right or wrong. And I don't feel we ever evolve. And that's what's great with comedies. You get to have these conversations.
We are just about out of time, but before we go, I want to ask you, if we sat down and had this conversation a year from now, right before the election,
yes,
next year, What do you hope you will have done with The Daily Show in that year?
What do I hope I will have done with The Daily Show? Number one, I would have hoped that I would have brought in a host of new viewers, young viewers. Like, you know, there's a lot of people who always tell me, I grew up watching Jon Stewart. I grew up watching The Daily Show. And that's a beautiful thing. Sometimes people forget there's a new generation that also needs to have that opportunity to grow up into it, to learn. Because, you know, we can't always complain and say, oh, these young people don't know, these dumb millennials, they don't know anything about, but they don't have a chance to learn it. So my job right now is to invite those people into the fold. My job right now is to get new people involved in politics, is to get black people involved in politics. A lot of black people just feel disenfranchised in America. I feel, you know, you have conversations where black people are going, what's the point? You know, I don't see what this country means to me anymore. I don't know if my voice is being heard anymore. And so if I can just get to a place where The Daily Show is an honest conversation being had with people out there, an honest conversation in and around events, in and around politics, then we can get to a place where I go, I made a tiny contribution. You know, I don't come from a place where I represent Democrat or Republican. We don't even have that in South Africa, so this is a whole new world for me. You know, we just go, that guy made a mistake, that guy said something right, she was horrible, she was great. That's all we do. That's all we do. Our views are not predisposed to what we think the other party should or shouldn't think. My goal right now is to come from an honest, bipartisan place, but also not fall into the trap that I feel some people have fallen into, and that is being tricked into being in an artificial middle, I find. You know, so like what's happened in America to a certain extent, it's fascinating to see from the outside, is you've got like right now in the Republican field, you have crazy people. You have many, many, in fact, I shouldn't say crazy people because that's offensive to people who do not have their full faculties. You have... they are extreme, they are brash, ideas are regressive in many, many ways and hurtful in many ways, racist ideas and xenophobic ideas. And you have these people that are so extreme that they've now made bad ideas just seem like normal ideas within their own party. And I don't know if that's part of the plan. If it is, it's worked really well. But I hope that we get to a place where we go, this is the truth of what is happening. This is the truth. And on the Democratic side as well, because I have no allegiances to anyone. It's the truth, you know? And sometimes I see people afraid to tell the truth. One example of this was, so we're in the office, and we're writing a show, and we're talking about how right now the media is creating this perception that police are in danger in America, creating this perception that police could get shot at any time, and police... But the numbers have shown statistically that there has not been a safer time to be a policeman in America. You know, if you look at the last few decades, this is the safest time to be a policeman. Fewer and fewer policemen are dying in America. Now, obviously, you want to get to the point where no policemen are dying, but there is progress being made, and yet the media makes it feel that the opposite is happening. And so policemen themselves, because people are working with anecdotal evidence instead of statistical evidence, are saying, I heard a friend and I saw a guy and there was a man who was, and this happened to me and a buddy of a buddy, and this is creating this buzz. And so we were writing the story, we were looking at it, we were dissecting it. And one of the counter arguments that comes in, because we have to argue with ourselves on the show, one of the counter arguments is, yeah, but then what do you say to police when they see Black Lives Matter protesters walking down the street chanting a slogan, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon? And the most interesting thing to me to see in the room was, you know, let's say most of my writing staff is white, and their first instinct was to joke and just be like, oh, well, that was a joke. They were making a joke about Waffle House or something. That was a, you know, and I realized their discomfort at pointing out, you know, something wrong that the protesters had done. It's that world of nuance. Because in my head, and I mean, unfortunately, we weren't on the air when that happened. This is when we were doing our test shows. In my head, I went, you deserve to be lambasted as much as a protest, as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. You deserve to be lambasted as much because you don't understand how much damage you've done with that slogan. Chanting that in the street has fueled a fire that now burns you. You know, you've gone against what you're trying to do. You have to be twice as good in that situation because you're trying to get a point across, you know? So if I can do anything in my tenure at The Daily Show, whether it's 1 year from now, 5 years from now, however long I may be there, it's just to be in an honest place. People can tune in and go, we're going to laugh, We're going to learn, but most importantly, it's honest. It may be self-skewering at times. You know, there's times when we're going to have to look on ourselves as progressives. There's times when we're going to have to look at whoever we think we may be supporting and go, actually, this is a mistake that we have made or our people have made. And there's going to be times where we get to laugh at the people that we may not be with. But the most important thing I'd want is for people to go into that election, and however many people are watching, say, part of the reason I'm making this decision is because I know the truth that I got from that show.
All right. We are out of time. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Have an hour.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Did you know that Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bissinger was addicted to buying leather pants? Or that there's a rare brain condition where you believe that you're already dead and don't exist? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.